morning, good afternoon, good evening, good middle of the night, wherever you may find yourself around the world. Welcome to Developpod. We're in our virtual studio with our fantastic Developpod team, James Taylor, Christian Tiplady, and myself, Tanya Merridew. Today, we're going to be talking about the what, the why, and the how of action research.
So, Christian, can you kick things off by giving us a definition of action research?
Sure. Kurt Lewin is generally attributed to having coined the term action research. It was in the field of social management in the 1940s, but really the British tradition took up action research and linked it to education. And it tended to a view that action research is oriented towards the enhancement of direct practice. So to answer your question, here's a classic definition from Carr and Kennis, 1986. Action research is simply a form of self-reflective inquiry undertaken by participants in order to improve the rationality and justice of their own practices, their understanding of these practices, and the situations in which the practices are carried out. That's Carr and Kennis, 1986, page 162, and we'll give you the reference.
This definition is from Michael J. Wallace, 1998, from his book, Action Research for Language Teachers. And on page 4, he has quite a nice accessible definition as well, quite similar to yours, Christian, with the action research basically being a way of reflecting on your teaching or teacher training or management of an English department. And it's done by systematically collecting data on your everyday practice and analyzing it in order to come to some decisions about what your future practice could or should be.
Yeah, so those definitions have a lot in common, I think, and many people are drawn to this kind of understanding of action research because it's firmly located in the realm of the practitioner, and it's very much tied to self-reflection, which is very current. For me, action research sounds a bit scary, and I think a lot of people may be put off by that. It's also been called classroom inquiry. Maybe that's a bit more accessible for teachers, or perhaps supported experiments if you're more of a scientific mind. Listen back to our Developpod 8, where Silvana Richardson of Bell International describes supported experiments very clearly.
Okay, so we've got an idea of what it means, but how would you define the purpose of action research?
Well, it's really to produce experience-based knowledge from our classrooms that is valid and useful and can guide us as teachers and guide our actions in ongoing planning and teaching. And I think we can become robotized, if you like, by our routines. And so action research can help us rethink and try out new things. The purpose of action research is not merely to reshuffle one's pack of teaching tactics. It's expressly designed to foster learning about one's practice and about alternative ways of constructing that practice. Kuramadevelu, 2001, called for a post-method methodology and a principled pragmatism that focuses on how learning can be shaped by teachers as a result of self-reflection and self-observation in the classroom. And I think this action research very efficiently does that. It looks at what works in the classroom. So as opposed to having some kind of blanket rule of thumb, I will do this in the classroom, adopt this technique, whether it be pair work or student talking time, or some greater methodology like task-based learning or audio-lingual method or communicative technique. Let's actually look at what works in the classroom.
So what would you say are the advantages of action research?
Well, I think central to that is that it's done by teachers for their own and other teachers' benefit. So it's often done in a very cooperative, collaborative way. It explores problems important to the teacher upon which they can attempt to find new solutions. And so it's very motivating because it's intrinsic to a teacher's very role, their core of existence, if you like, what works for them and in their classroom and particularly for the students. So it's also in contrast to perhaps more mainstream science or theory-based linguistics that, and there's been a perception in the past that that's been hoisted on us as teachers. And that knowledge at least the perception goes, cannot guide us as practitioners, as teachers, in our particular context. And perhaps the concerns of linguists and theorists are not our own concerns. Anyway, so it's very practical and it's very applicable, let's say. The next thing really is that it's immediately applicable. We can find improvements or solutions. And I'm not even necessarily saying always has to be about problems, but we can find tweaks in what we do in terms of the teacher, the process, and ultimately the learner. So it's very applicable and it's instant. It's also, according to Stringer, 1999, and you look on page 9 and 10, he talks about action research in a community-based or participatory setting. He really sings it praises and says it's democratic, it's equitable, so acknowledging people's worth and the equality of their worth. It's liberating, provides freedom from debilitating conditions and the oppressive nature perhaps of being stuck in a box and having other theorists' ideas imposed on us perhaps. And it's also life-enhancing, enables the expression of people's full human potential. Well, they're very worthy and grand sentiments, but perhaps there's some truth in some of those.
I'd like to jump in as a link to our last Developpod podcast, Christian, as well, with Patrice talking about empowerment. Mm-hmm. And I think that word seems to fit quite nicely here, too, that I think that it really does help foster a sense of community. It helps foster that kind of break away from the isolation a lot of teachers feel, mm-hmm. and that ability to feel their own agency, to kind of tap into the wider expertise that's available around them, that they can then really use for their own purposes. So I think empowerment's also incorporated there too.
Okay, so let's think about if there are any negatives. I mean, one of my concerns, to be honest, about action research is the validity of the research that it provides. Is that a concern as well, do you think?
I think in the beginning there were questions underlying action research concerning its rigor and the training perhaps of those undertaking the action research. But the matter comes down to the fact that the action researchers, those doing supported experiments, if you like, or a classroom-based inquiry, are not claiming to be empirical researchers. They're not claiming to extend that research beyond the boundaries of their classroom. And so as long as it's done with honesty and an inquiring mind, who can say whether that's valid or not? And it is often presented at research conferences or conferences like IOTEFL. That said, there's always with the context, this is my context, this is what I did, and this is what I found. And so I don't think you can say fairer than that.
And I think in that situation where you're talking about people presenting their very context-specific research in conferences, it's important to note that it is kind of undergoing a certain amount of peer scrutiny, that people then can partake in the collaborative nature of action research, where that research may not be immediately valid or replicable or relatable to their context, but it can also inspire them in different ways to adapt their own research or questioning to their own context. So it's not a case that research is presented as just take this and swallow it and apply it to all situations. It's a conversation.
So James, did that convince you?
I think in general, I'm someone who's quite strongly in favor of empirical evidence. I found that more meaningful to me. I think you have to be careful about how much weight you put into the results of action research. But that said, I think that there's a lot that teachers can gain from having the opportunity to go through the process of doing action research as a form of teacher development and self-reflection. So I'm not saying that the process has no value.
I think it's also important just to throw this in that we don't have to think of it in such a kind of a dualistic way. I think that both rigorous, far-reaching, more deeply empirical studies that have far larger populations that can cut across different contexts, of course that has a place, but also very localized, independent study also has a place. So I wouldn't say that they both have a role in furthering what we do as individuals and how our field develops. I think they just have different roles.
I think it very much depends on how you view the role of those two things within our profession, right? I don't think you necessarily have to see them as kind of both fulfilling the same function, but just done in different ways. Mm-hmm. They both have different objectives, I think, and the results of those two things manifest themselves in completely different ways. So, yeah, I don't think they're necessarily competitive. I think they're just two completely separate things.
Mm-hmm. So now we've had the what's and the why and the benefits and potential downside. So what about the how? Tanya, can you give us some steps in brief how to do action research?
Sure. There's a few ways of kind of thinking of it. I like the Stringer's 1999 encapsulated view of look, think, and act. But I'd like to unpack that a little bit further. So when we think about looking, I think that something that is very beneficial for people is to either do a topic research or to think of a very specific problem or issue that they're having with their individual context or their local context. I think that action research can be very motivating, and you can have a, for lack of a better term, a lot of stick with itness and follow it through if people do find it very meaningful for their particular situation. So I think really uncovering a specific problem or an issue, something that kind of keeps coming back, keep having issues with this. This is always kind of around the back of my head. Why is this not working out for me? Gives people a lot of motivation for continuing through the whole process. So the first thing, which I suppose could be considered under the look aspect, is what is the specific problem? And problems can fall in lots of different areas. For it could be a problem with classroom management. It could be a problem with materials or materials adaptation. It could be a problem related to specific teaching area, reading skills, productive skills, assessment. It could be a problem relating to one's personal management issues, time management, relationships with colleagues. And from a management perspective or an academic director's perspective, how are they fulfilling their roles? So I think that really isolating the topic is quite important. So Christian or James, thinking about your particular context, what action research topic or problem or issue would you be concerned with right now?
Well, I think I'm eager personally to move away from problems per se. And I'm wanting to incorporate more flipped learning into my classes, whether it be my English language classes or my teacher training work that I do. And I've been doing that more whilst I've been here on this diploma in TESOL course in Hungary. But I really want to know whether it's effective or not. Mm-hmm. And I've asked participants and they seem to get on with the style, but I think I need to do that more scientifically. So how can I frame that and limit it?
Well, I think the first thing is, what is the precise question you need to ask yourself? Then you need to think of the outcome. What is the product? What is the likely outcome of your research as you kind of intend it? Where do you hope it's going to get you? Then how are you going to do the research? What evidence are you actually going to be looking for, and in what mode, what format? Mm-hmm. So for example, are you going to take field notes? Are you going to do an interview? Are you journaling? Are you creating a survey? Are you going to write a journal, a classroom log? So really trying to isolate the how, the actual mechanism that could work with you, but also that really fits into your timing. So choosing one that really correlates nicely with the timing as well, because you maybe only have 1 week to look at this, or maybe it's something you want to explore over 6 months. So then the mode of the data collection can be altered to suit the timing, your deadlines. I think another consideration is your resources. what resources are you looking at? Your own human resources, material resources? Is there collaboration involved? Can you ask somebody else to be involved with your data collection? And then it's also important to think or to be cognizant that this is not a straight line, that there's a lot of people will bump into refocusing, fine-tuning, and adapting. And that's fine. That's absolutely cool. That's part of the process, and to not feel stressed about it. So I would say those procedures, when those are identified, it allows a clear scope of how to move forward in answering those questions.
Okay, Tanya, I'll be honest with you. That's a lot of information to take in, right? So can you boil it down for us, make it simpler? Let's think about this step by step.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, so step by step, let's go back to Stringer's view of the look, the think, and the act. So you're looking for a problem. You're trying to identify a specific question. Then you have to ask yourself, what evidence can you look for to help answer that question? And how are you going to gather that evidence? That is a way that suits the time frame that you have to do it in. And then it's manageable. It's information that you can look at, and it's manageable for you to review it. So that is the thinking part. What procedures are you going to have? What timing do you have? What resources do you have? And then the acting is, can you try it out in your classroom? Can you share it with another person? Can you discuss it with a colleague? And then again, it's that idea of reflecting and maybe even reformulating what you have. All of the steps, it's important to be taken with an attitude of curiosity and openness and the idea that it's not stressful. It's not something that people should feel imposed upon them, that it's more of a kind of a very lighthearted Sherlock Holmes way of investigating an area of teaching.
Tanya, I'm back on board now.
Yay!
That seems manageable and simple enough for me to get my head around. So in terms of my exploration about the flipped learning, I need to look at my situation and continue to plan it in. But gather information, I'm thinking two ways, maybe my own teacher log and use questionnaires. I think always questionnaires are an easy and very solid way, if they're well designed, of gathering information.
Mm-hmm.
And then continue to use it with teachers and teacher trainees and with English language students. And maybe it will be very different in those two environments.
Mm-hmm. And I think I'll add to that in trying not to be too committed to the outcome, trying not to be too committed or too biased in, it's not that you're researching something to confirm what you're already thinking. Because sometimes when you're doing research, maybe a very dearly held pedagogical belief is shattered.
But I want to ask, if it's so context focused, surely flipped classroom is going to be appropriate with some students in some context, and a traditional input is going to be with others. What will my action research really have revealed?
Yeah. Oh, totally. And I think that goes back to James's concern with it. I think it is useful in that most people work in the same context, in the same institution, for example, generally the same population of students, roughly within the same curriculum. So it may not be applicable to other institutions, but it can certainly help facilitate your practice, even for the next year or so, as you try it out. And I also go back to the benefit of the peer collaboration, that there is a certain energizing factor within any faculty department that needs to kind of continually be there so that people don't get stagnant, that people don't feel that they're in the rut. So even one person's very, very specifically located piece of action research can be enough to kind of stimulate a little wave through the faculty where other people start to think, well, you know, it's funny that you're researching flipped classroom because I've heard about that, but I'm not mm-hmm. really that interested in it. But now suddenly they have a local expert, if you like. So mm-hmm. I think it can feed into other conversations. So James, if people are interested in diving deeper into this very large topic of action research, what resources would you recommend people start to look at?
Well, if someone wants to start with a bit more of an academic inquiry, then I've been looking at the work of an Australian professor called Anne Burns, who's written a couple of books on this topic. And the reason I looked to her was because her books are specifically about action research related to ELT, which there's a lot of action research books out there, but not too many that are specifically on English language teaching. So her first book was published in 1999 called Collaborative Action Research for English Language Teachers, published by Cambridge in their Resource Book for Teachers series. And that's basically, it's a how-to guide. So it is reasonably accessible. It has all the background on action research and it does go through the steps required, but it also has, you know, obviously the methodology and the theory behind it as well. And at the end of the book, it has case studies. So it is a good book. It explains everything you need. So then she followed that up in 2010 with another book for Routledge called Doing Action Research in English Language Teaching. And this is it's a similar book, but it's more user-friendly, I found. There are tasks throughout the book, and there are the case studies as well are used inside the chapters. So it's more easily accessible, I think, than the Cambridge one. But they're broadly similar books, but obviously the 2010 one is more up-to-date.
And another book, just to reiterate, is The Action Research for Language Teachers, by Michael J. Wallace. That's the one that seems to be quite frequently used on a lot of master's programs and was also used on my master's program. James, could you recommend any practical resources or links?
Sure. Well, not surprisingly, the British Council Teaching English site has a lot of stuff about action research on it. And so there are a lot of links, and we're obviously going to include all of the links to everything in our show notes for this episode. But the one I would recommend most highly is actually a handbook that you can download called A Handbook for Exploratory Action Research by Richard Smith and Paula Rebeledo. And this is probably the highest recommendation I would have from what I looked at. It's very user-friendly. It's very step-by-step for your action research project. So it takes you through each element of it. It has tasks and it has case studies as well. There are lots and lots of examples, and it's deliberately written to be very accessible for teachers who've never done this before, and it's free. So it's really an excellent book. So I would highly recommend that if you're thinking of starting off with some action research. And then the final thing I just want to mention is that as we are a IATEFL SIG, I felt we should give a mention to the IATEFL's research SIG, our comrades over there. So they don't just deal with action research specifically, but I think if anyone's interested in looking into research, then they're definitely the place to go. So you can find them on Twitter and Facebook do a search for RESIG, Research SIG. And they have resources. And I would really recommend as well, Richard Smith, who I just mentioned, who wrote that book, is a really interesting follow on Twitter as well for things related to research. So that's Richard Smith, ELT.
Thanks, James. That was interesting. Good luck with your action research, everybody. And now over to Tyson for the latest TDSIG news.
Hi. I'm Tyson Seaburn, and I'd like to share a couple of exciting things we're up to, or rather, hopefully some of you may be up to soon. First, we're looking for a new TDSIG committee member to join our team as of the IATEFL conference in Manchester. This person will help shape our voice on social media and work on delivering different types of scholarships and member competitions. If you'd like to collaborate with us on these projects and you're a paid IATEFL member, we'd really invite you to apply by March 1st. And secondly, registration is open for our pre-conference event in Manchester at the IATEFL conference itself. There, we're going to explore localized teacher-driven development projects with a sustainable impact on our teaching, like action research, dialogic pedagogy, problematization, and reflective practice. Four teachers from different contexts around the world are going to lay out their TD projects and experiences with us, and then we'll dig more deeply into them with them in open space dialogues throughout the day so we can each understand the ups and downs, mostly ups, of these types of approaches to teacher development. For more info about either of these opportunities or to register for the PCE, please go to our website, tdsig.org.
So thanks very much for another very interesting DevelopPod podcast. Thank you to James.
Thank you.
And thank you to Christian.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And do keep in touch by following us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at TDSIG. Thanks again, and see you next time.